Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events. Major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories. The unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, good evening and welcome to the John Whitmer Show, sponsored by Wink Hartman and the Hartman Group of Companies. I know I said this last week, but gosh, it's good to be back. We are happy you joined us tonight here at your liberal resistance headquarters, where we proudly champion the conservative principles. You're going to hear this again in a few minutes, but a limited government, individual liberty, free enterprise, and traditional values. Very happy to have you with me this evening. If you'd like to call in, the studio lines are open. I'm trying to take more calls throughout the show, so call anytime, 316-869-1330. You can find me at on email or by email at john@knssradio.com. I'm out of practice. At Facebook, at the John Whitmer Show, and on X, at John R. Whitmer. Reach out. I'd love to hear from you. We've got, this is going to be a fascinating show tonight. I'm going to duck and cover, because coming up after the top of the hour break, coming up at 8 o'clock, former Trump White House communications director Anthony Scaramucci, the Mooch, will be with us. He is not a fan of Donald Trump, and I'm sure that will come up. I'm sure we will discuss the fact that that the Mooch is backing Biden. I don't know why, but he is. But we'll discuss what it's like to go from Wall Street to the heart of the Trump White House, albeit for 11 days, and to explain why he's become one of the former president's most outspoken critics. Legal expert and former FEC commissioner Hans von Spakovsky will tell us why he says the Trump verdict makes New York City Venezuela on the Hudson. We'll begin our 2024 election candidate profiles with a conversation with Stephanie Wise, who is a candidate for Sedgwick County Commission District 3. And now that the filing deadline has passed, House Speaker Dan Hawkins will join us to preview the election and review some key legislative races and talk a little bit about what's coming up in the special session. And, of course, we'll take your calls, 316-869-1330. So I mentioned we're going to talk a little bit about the core principles. And so at this point, folks, it's time to gather around the digital campfire once again and discuss the state of our nation, the state of our state, and the stakes of this upcoming election. I know we're going to talk with Dan about this, but this is a call to action. Now that we know who's running, now that we know the shape of the upcoming elections, this call to action echoes through the corridors of, well, frankly, of liberty. And I'm here to remind you that now more than ever, we must stand together as guardians of those core conservative values, warriors for the cause of freedom and stewards of the American dream, stewards of the principles that we hold most dear. And as the dust settles and the candidates step onto the proverbial political battlefield, the filing deadline now behind us, we find ourselves at a pivotal moment in history. This election, and I've said this before, you hear it all the time, this election is an important one, but this is not just a political skirmish. It's a turning point, a crossroads, where the fate of our state and our nation really hangs in the balance. And make no mistake, the stakes could not be higher for conservatives and Republicans alike. And for the record, I'm proudly voting for a convicted felon in November, and I have no issue with that. Because if you have a sham trial, it brings about sham convictions. What else should we have expected? But now is time to get pissed, folks. Now is time to get motivated. They won a battle. We need to win the war. And it's not a time for complacency. This is not a time for apathy. This is a time for action. It's not a time to sit on your couch. It's a time to get off your duff. My wife and I get out and knock doors every week. We spend between 15 and 20 hours every week door knocking for candidates, door knocking for our principals. You need to do the same thing. I'm almost 60. If I can do it, you can do it. I'm overweight. I'm losing weight. You can do it. If you can't door knock, write a check. If you can't write a check, make a phone call. But get involved. This is a time to rise up, to stand tall, and to make our voices heard in every corner of this state. We cannot afford to sit idly by and watch as the forces of tyranny, of socialism, of gender ideology, and oppression chip away at the very foundation of our republic. So what must we do? We must do what Americans have always done in times of crisis. We must vote. We must donate. And above all, we must get active, roll up our sleeves, lace up our boots, and march forward into the fray. And as I said, that means knocking on doors. That means walking in a parade. That means putting up a yard sign. That means making phone calls. That means getting involved in campaigns at every level of government, from county commission to the hallowed halls of Congress to the presidency, because the truth is every race matters. Every seat counts. And the future of our values depends on the actions we take today. And you know, you hear me talk about it all the time. It's the core values on this show. You know what they are. Individual liberty, limited government, free enterprise, traditional values. We champion those every Sunday. But what do they mean? Limited government means that we believe in the power of the individual, not the heavy hand of the state, to solve our problems and to drive progress. It means we reject the notion of an all-powerful government that seeks to control every aspect of our lives. That's a Democrat principle. Individual liberty means that we believe in the inherent dignity and worth of every human being. It means that we cherish the freedoms enshrined in our Constitution. The freedom of speech, the freedom of religion, the freedom to bear arms. And we will fight for those principles and defend them against all who seek to take them away, you know, like Democrats. Free enterprise means that we believe in the power of the free market to create wealth, opportunity, and prosperity for all, equal access, not government mandates. It believes we reject the siren song of socialism and the false promise of government handouts, and instead embrace the entrepreneurial spirit that has made America the greatest nation on the earth. And traditional values are those that define our culture, the sanctity of life, the importance of family, and the timeless truths that have guided humanity for centuries. It means that we stand firm in the face of cultural decay and moral relativism. And we strive to build a society that honors God, respects tradition, and upholds the Judeo-Christian principles upon which our civilization was built, unlike Democrats. So, patriots, as we stand on the cusp of another election, let us remember who we are and what we stand for. Let us remember the sacrifices of those who came before us and the blessings of liberty that we have inherited. And let us remember that we are one generation away from losing those. And let us resolve to do what it takes to ensure that those blessings are preserved for the generations to come. This is our moment. This is our calling. And together we need to rise to the challenge. So tomorrow, commit yourselves to volunteering on a campaign. Contact a county party, contact a candidate, or heck, reach out to me. I'll gladly advise you on who needs assistance and why. I can give you some suggestions. Contact the speaker's office. He can give you some guidance on who needs help and who doesn't. Contact Senator Masterson. He can tell you. The bottom line is the battle is upon us and we need all hands on deck. And if you don't show up, if you don't get activated, if you don't write a check or knock a door or make a phone call or put out a yard sign, then you have no one to blame but yourself. Every seat in the Kansas legislature, 125 of them in total in the House and 40 in the Senate, is up for election this year. Republicans are attempting to hold on to and hopefully expand their veto-proof majorities in both chambers. With us now to preview the election and review the key races to watch is Speaker of the House Dan Hawkins. Brother, nice to have you. It was just a couple weeks. Nice to have you back on the show.
Good evening, John.
It was fun. It's nice to be back behind a mic. But we had a little bit of fun when I had guest hosts in.
Oh, I kind of like Blake Carpenter being the host.
You would say that, though. Did he pay you to say that?
No, he didn't.
Yeah. So let me ask you. So across the state, Republicans have 32 primaries, 12 in the Senate, 20 in the House, while Democrats have 11 contested primaries. I guess there just aren't enough liberals for the liberals out there. 4 in the Senate and 7 in the House. Tell us some of the races that the listeners should be watching, should be taking an eye out.
So here in Sedgwick County, actually, we're in pretty good shape. And I say in South Central Kansas, we're in pretty good shape. Really, the ones we're watching here is, of course, Sandy Pickard.
Yep.
There's a Democrat primary in that district. And then whoever the winner is will go against Sandy. Sandy's out there working right now.
Yep, my wife and I were knocking for her a couple weeks ago. Good responses.
Absolutely. No, it's going very, very well with her. We had 4 folks here in the Wichita, Sedgwick County area, actually South Central Kansas, that did not have a race. So Susan Humphries, Bill Riley, Leo Delperdang, and Joe Seiwert got by without
us. And our buddy Blake.
And Blake, 5.
Yeah, 5.
That's
yep,
5.
Yep. I don't know. How is it Blake keeps getting these?
You know,
these
this is his
passes?
Second. This
I'm going to move into Derby and run against him next time.
This is his second cycle to not have a race.
I know.
Actually, it's good, though, because we can use Blake. He'll go across the state helping others.
I called him after that, and I said, when are the Democrats going to realize that you're one of the hardest working guys in speaking?
He is. He literally, during the last election cycle, he went up and spent, I don't know, a month,
In Kansas City, yeah.
In Kansas City, working for those
They
up
should
there.
Run against him just for no other reason than to keep him from helping everybody else.
So when I saw that, I thought, hey, we've got our guy back out on the road. He'll be working. So
do you feel
thing.
Confident? Based, Probst, I know, Dowden Hutch.
Yeah, so we got
somebody
yeah,
there.
We actually have a primary there. We think we'll have the right guy win that one, and then Probst going to have a tough time winning this time.
For the listeners, Probst is the Democrat in a district in Hutchinson that really should be a Republican.
It is a Republican district. It's just that he's been there for, 6 years now, I believe it is.
So, do you feel confident that we can pick that one up?
I think we can. I think that one's we've got a good guy that they went out and recruited. There's actually 2 in, and one that just showed up and one that was recruited. And I think the guy that's recruited probably will end up winning that one.
So, you know, Laura Kelly's, I think it's, I've heard multiple figures on how much she's raised in her PACs. I've heard as much as $8 million, but bottom line is she's going to have a lot of money.
It's not that big. Her middle-of-the-road PAC, I've heard somewhere close to $2
million. Okay, $2
million. We're going to raise $1.5 million for RHCC, Republican House Campaign Committee. And that's what we use to defend and also go on offense and win some new seats. So we'll have $1.5 million there. And then there's some favorable PACs out there that'll help us out. So I'm thinking there's probably going to be close to $2 million on our side that we'll be using. And plus everything that our candidates go out there and raise on their own. So we should be in pretty good shape.
So obviously her goal is to break those supermajorities in either or both chambers so that she can get her agenda through. That's really what it comes down to. So you stop vetoing things like, transgender sports and things like that. That's what she wants. She wants to get her agenda through.
That's her job. And our job is to keep her from doing that.
Do you think she can accomplish that?
I do not. I think that when the smoke settles, and everything is out there and open, I think that we will be at 87. That's my prediction. I think we'll pick up 2, maybe 3 seats. We might lose one, but I think we'll pick up enough that we could have a net 87. I think the Senate's going to do fine, too.
I was going to say, what about the lower chamber?
Yeah, I think the Senate is going to do very well. They will, they've certainly got good candidates and they work hard. I don't think they've raised quite as much money as we have, but of course then they're 40 and we're, 85 right now. So we've got twice as many members as they have. Actually, that's not true. We've probably got 3 times because they've only got 29.
Right.
One of the races that everybody is going to watch, John, is in the Senate. And it's
Pyle. Yep,
and
I knew that was coming.
Yeah, it's Pyle and the 2 others that are running against him. I wish there was only one. Wish it wasn't a 3-way. a heads up battle would be much better for us seeing Pyle go bye-bye.
Oh, yeah, Pyle's like a tick. He's going to be hard to get
out. But I actually think that there's, from what I'm hearing, just, from evidence of the door knocking so far, people are tired of Pyle. So I think Pyle's going to have a tough road.
Good.
So I think we could actually see, him be gone. And if he is, that just changes the whole complexion in the Senate.
Well, and there's other changes that we may see shiftings to the conservative side. I mean, you've got like Younger and some other races in the House, over in the Senate, Olson being gone, Stefan being gone. Oh, yeah. There's some other changes that it's still R to R, but it's a more manageable, let's be nice and say, a more team-oriented R versus some of these Rs that have just been, shall we say, pains in the patoots.
Oh, yeah. So Younger is actually gone. He's moved. He doesn't own a house in that district anymore. We'll probably see him resign soon.
John Dahl, there's another one in the Senate that just to be difficult.
We need to get Marty Long back out in Ulysses. We need to get him back, and if we get him back, that's going to be awesome. One of the interesting things is Mark Schreiber up in Emporia hasn't had a primary, and I can't remember.
I remember. I served. Mark sat right in front of me on the House floor,
and he picked up a primary. So we'll see how that one goes.
There's somebody I might need to send some money to. I know that's really the key here. If I mentioned it in the monologue, if folks can, they really need to help. They need to write a check if they can.
Yeah, here and you can certainly support your candidate in your district, but you can also give to the county party. Our county party is an active party, and they need money, so they need help. They've recruited candidates, and they want to help those candidates. So there's a lot of opportunity. And truly, if you just go talk to the county party, they'll tell you where they need your help, whether it's manpower, whether it's phone banking, whether it's money. They'll tell you exactly where they need help.
We're talking with Speaker of the House Dan Hawkins. I know we're kind of coming up towards the end of the segment, but as many of our listeners know, Governor Kelly's called for the special session to be held later this month on the 18th. I know that you and Ty have said that tax relief is absolutely number one focus.
It is.
But there's been a lot of talk about the Star Bond proposal to draw the Chiefs and now the Royals to move to Kansas. Are you at all afraid of getting distracted by this issue?
Not at all. Actually, Ty and I have made it absolutely clear that tax relief, us getting a tax relief package, is the number one thing. It has been ever since we left session, and we knew that she was going to call us back. We've talked about it. We certainly have had discussions with the governor's staff. Again, they moved the goalpost on us every time.
Oh, yeah, multiple times.
That goalpost has been moved again. We kind of know where it's at. We hope she doesn't move it further. But I think that if she doesn't, I think we are going to be very close to where she says she would like to see it. And we expect her to sign this bill. And I say that every interview I do.
You said that the last time.
We expect her to sign this bill. So tax is the number one issue. The other one is kind of new, and quite frankly, we have to wait and see where the votes are at. If there's enough votes to bring that up, we'll bring it up. If there's not, we're not going to bring it up.
So let's talk about the proposal. There's been a lot of information. There's been misinformation going around about the proposal.
Lots of misinformation.
For those who don't know what STAR bonds it stands for sales tax and revenue bonds. They're a financing tool that allows Kansas cities to use state and local sales tax revenue to fund major commercial, entertainment, and tourism projects. The bonds are then paid off using the increased sales tax generated in the area. STAR bonds can help pay for property acquisition, site preparation, infrastructure, and related attractions. Typically, Dan, these STAR bond projects require the developer to put up 50% of the investment. I know there's been speculation on this package. Some have said it's going to be 100%. Basically, the developer won't have to put up any money.
I can tell you it's not 100%.
So they are going to have to put some in.
Absolutely. Okay, absolutely. And we don't know exactly what, what that mix is going to be. We're going to find out when we see the bill and certainly see, some of the proposals. But it has to be at least It's going to be a maximum of 75%.
Okay, so they'll have to at least put in some of it, which is good. That means that the Chiefs or the Hunts or whoever. Yeah,
and the figure that's kind of been thrown out there by Sean Tarwater is $500 million. I don't know if that's the figure or not, but that's what he's set up in Kansas City. So he's our guy, so I assume he knows what he's talking about.
While the stadium district qualify for other state or local subsidy programs, or is this really the only?
Okay, no, so. And people need to understand that this project is what Starbonds was made for. The Kansas Speedway is the best Starbond project that has ever been done, and it paid off. In fact, all of the projects that have paid off all paid off early. Not a single, and this is misinformation that's being put out there, not a single Starbond has went belly up. Not a single one. Even the Prairie Fire, which has not done well up in Kansas City, they missed one payment, but they are still paying. So they've actually, Prairie Fire is gone and they're bringing a new attraction in, and they believe the new attraction will go on ahead and make that truly a viable, project. So the projects have done well. And so think about that. This is a tool, and it truly is a tool that it's like a user fee. If you go, so let's say the Chiefs do come to Kansas. If you go to the Chiefs area, you go to that area and you buy things, all the sales tax from the things that are purchased in that area.
Concessions or phone fingers or whatever.
Everything. Yeah, okay. Retail establishments, everything. Those sales tax revenues will go to pay off those star bonds. Not anything, nothing, zero comes from the state general fund, and the taxpayers are not on the hook for it. There's been a lot of misinformation saying that the state's on the hook for it, the cities are on the hook for it, the counties are on the hook for it. Not at all. The person who takes the risk is the bondholder, and they evaluate that risk, and they decide if it's worth it, and then they buy the bonds. If they buy the bonds, then they've accepted the risk. That risk is never on the taxpayer. Taxpayer has no risk in this. What a great way to do it. This is the prime way to do a project like this, and we look at this project to be similar to the Speedway project that went very well. This one will go very well, too.
Are you at all concerned? And you know, I've been through special sessions. I've been through regular sessions. Are you at all concerned with the objection that says it should be done through regular order, through the committee process, going through hearings, feedback, you know, as opposed to a special session? That's the one thing that sticks up for me that I
don't know. So we will have a hearing. We're going to have a joint hearing on the Monday, and that hearing will probably go longer than a hearing that would have been in the, you know what a hearing is like?
An hour and a half at most.
And literally, Sean has been given the whole day.
Okay.
And
so
and I've told him, I said, you need to take as long as it takes to vet this project and make sure it's right and make sure everybody on that committee understands it. Well, that doesn't happen during regular sessions.
No,
so when they talk
session,
about regular those, order, yeah. You get an hour and a half.
Yeah, literally an hour and a half.
That's all you get.
For both sides.
That's right.
Yeah.
For both sides. They may do this for 4 or 5 hours on that day.
Okay, so that is more time than
they're going to have much more time than we would during regular order. I mean, this is really the best situation. They're going to get a vet it well on Monday, on Tuesday. If there's the votes, we'll bring it up. If there's not, we're not going to bring it up.
Well,
simple as that.
It sounds like you're giving it a fair time. We are going to, next Sunday, we're going to have proponents and opponents on this. We'll have someone from the Scoop and Score group.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have someone from the opposition group come on the show separately. I don't want to deal with a debate or anything. We're just going to have each of them come on for a segment, and we'll discuss it out. We'll see how it goes. Either way, Dan, I appreciate you. I appreciate you taking the time to sit down with us as always. If folks want to connect with you, what's the best way for them to do so? What's the best way for them to get your newsletter, that kind of stuff?
Am I done? Is this all I get?
That's all you get, man.
Wow, dude, you need to give me more time.
I got Stephanie sitting right here. She got a campaign to run, brother.
It's danhawkinskansas.com. They can go on my website, go down to the bottom of the landing page, and they can sign up for my newsletter. Comes out every Friday morning by email. I think I've got 12,000 now on my newsletter distribution list. So.
Wow. I need to get your distribution list. Dan, thank you again for joining us. I appreciate you, my friend, as always.
Thanks, John.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events. Major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs, But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories, the unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Every election cycle, we try to bring you as many candidates running for local, state, and federal office as we can, so you have the opportunity to hear from them firsthand. I endeavor to invite every candidate registered on the ballot to appear on the show. Most accept our invitations. Often the Democrats don't, but some do. Some of them just choose not to for whatever reason, but we invite them nonetheless. So each week between now and Election Day, we will try and bring you a candidate or two. If there's someone in particular you'd like to hear from, please email me. Let me know. We will invite them on the show. All that being said, joining us now is Stephanie Wise. She is a candidate for Sedgwick County Commission District 3, which is my county commission district. So I've got, you know, I got stake in this particular race. She was born and raised in Sedgwick County, attended Goddard Public Schools. She's a broker at Street Commercial and currently serves on the District 3 Citizens Advisory Board. That's all the bio stuff I could find. I need more bio on your website. Stephanie, thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you, John. Glad to be here.
So let me ask you this. This is the same question I ask every candidate is, why are you running? Why bother to get into this nightmare? Because running for office, as I'm sure you've been at it for a while now, running for office is tough. Why are you running?
Yeah, well, you know, I saw an opportunity with a vacating seat. So with David Dennis not running, it's a great opportunity for my generation to have a conservative voice on our commission. And so that is my goal, and that's why I'm running.
So I heard at a forum recently, I don't know which forum it was. You've attended a lot. You've been very active. I'll give you credit for that. That you told the group at this recent, or it was a fundraiser, I guess it was a fundraiser or something. You said you were only going to run for one term. Is that true? You only want to run for one term?
One or two. I mean, I'll look, you know, a lot of this is going to be where God puts me and where the citizens want to have me. But, my goal is not to be a career politician. So I want to come in, share my leadership, share my conservative values. And then, you know, I'm okay to let the next conservative person in. And I think that that's where we can find success in local government, is getting people in these seats that are in there for a time. And sometimes it's longer than others. And I don't judge anyone that spends longer. I just know personally, you know, I'm not looking to be a career politician. I just really want to serve my community well.
I know you've said publicly that you don't plan to quit your full-time job. The Sedgwick County Commission, I've always seen it as a full-time job in and of itself. Do you not consider it a full-time job?
I see and understand it as a full-time job. So I'm self-employed. I've always managed my time and my workload appropriately. And I do know that I'm making a great sacrifice by running for this position, to serve the county. And I know that it's going to affect my business. And so I have, what they don't ever capture when I say that is, I have been training someone for the past year to help carry my load. And because I don't plan to be here forever in politics, I do want to go back to my business. I love commercial real estate. I love representing small business owners. And so I have put the plans in place to do this. And I think I've put a great plan in place to do that. And county will take number one position, and it absolutely will have my full attention and understanding of its requirements.
I think that's smart. And you have to do that. You're right. And especially for $100,000 a year, I think that's the right, that needs to be the number one priority. I think that's smart. Yep. You told the Wichita Eagle that if elected, your focus would be on infrastructure and smart economic growth. How would you propose to accomplish that? What to you is the definition of smart economic growth? How would you focus on infrastructure?
Well, in my district specifically, in District 3, a lot of the cases that come to our Citizens Advisory Board is housing developments and growth in smaller cities like Colwich, Andale, Goddard, seeing a lot too. And they're really concerned about what the the right growth plan is. And when we have a growth opportunity, that we have the infrastructure, do we have the water sources needed to put in the houses that are being proposed? Roads, we have to look at the roads. You know, I know Kellogg East or West Kellogg has been kind of teed up to have the growth for a while.
Yeah.
And then they're talking about the Northwest Expressway. So, I mean, what comes first and what's the responsible thing to do as far as continuing to grow the West Side in District 3, but also doing it not by force, but by natural and needed expansion.
You mentioned the Citizens Advisory Board. You mentioned the growth and is particularly affordable housing. It's a major issue countywide. I serve on the City District Advisory Board out there. Jeff Blubaugh's.
Yeah.
So I'm familiar with the District 4. Recently, the county denied an application for an affordable housing development in Goddard using state's RHID program. Mm-hmm. Had you been on the county commission, would you have denied that application? I mean, that was affordable housing in Goddard in the district. I'm curious what you would have done had you been on the commission with that particular vote, for
example. That's a loaded question.
I'm not all that familiar with the deal. I remember seeing it and thinking to myself, well, it's affordable housing. It's, you know, it was apartments, but it also had the options for duplexes. It had the option for single family homes. And I thought to myself, well, you know, is this a, we don't like the developer, or is this, we don't like affordable housing in Goddard?
Yeah. I mean, I think the question to that was, is that what that program is meant for? So we have star bonds out there that have not maybe come to their full success yet with development out in Goddard. And I know that those apartments would have helped with that. Maybe that wasn't the project that they saw the need of those apartments. I know that their big feedback to that specific project and that specific vote was that we have a lot of other developers in and around Wichita that are developing apartments, and they're not utilizing this additional funding or incentive.
RHID, right.
So I think that was what their challenge was, is when the county was looking at the return, they saw a return that should be acceptable from a developer. And the developer wasn't seeing that return the same way. So that's a really tough one. And I'm from Goddard, so I would love to see the growth for affordable housing out there. And perhaps it's a different project that needs to happen.
With us still is Stephanie Wise, candidate for Sedgwick County District 3. So, Stephanie, let me start with property taxes. It's probably the biggest issue. I know when I was out door knocking, when I was running in my house race, which is about half of it's in District 3, and even as we're out door knocking now for Americans for Prosperity, taxes is a big issue. Each year, after appraised values are set, mill rates should be reduced so that the new valuations deliver the same dollar amount of property taxes as budgeted the year before. Hence the name revenue neutral. That's the concept that we've talked about for years. However, Sedgwick County has not done that. Since 2022, only 32% of Sedgwick County residents have not seen an increase in their property taxes due to these revenue neutral rates. In fact, 23% of residents have seen their taxes go up by at least 5%. 34% of residents have seen their property taxes rise over 10%. On your website, you say, quote, "I will always fight to keep your taxes low and the government budget lean." Will you commit to not raising property taxes by pledging to reduce the mill levy so that after appraised values are set, you will vote to lower the mill rate so that the new valuations deliver the same dollar amount of property taxes as budgeted the year before? Hold on. There you go.
Oh,
sorry.
Yes, I will commit that everything that I do is going to be focused on running the most lean and efficient budget possible.
Okay. That's political speak, which great.
Sure,
for a new
sure.
candidate, you've mastered the art of political speak. But that's not what I'm asking. And I'm going to do the same thing to everybody else on this question who's running for county. Mm-hmm. Will you commit? Because this is what David Dennis did. And frankly, since this is who you're voting to replace, it pissed me off. I want a candidate who will commit to hold us revenue neutral. So that's my question. Yes or no, will you vote to hold us revenue neutral, to stop allowing property taxes? Mine went up 18% last year alone. Yeah. In the last 10 years, my house has gone up by $100,000, and all I've done is mow the lawn.
Right.
So here's my question again. Will you vote to lower the mill rate so that the new valuations deliver the same dollar amount of property tax as budgeted the year before? Yes or no?
Yes, you can count on my vote.
There you go.
Yes.
That's fantastic. That's what holding the line is.
Yeah.
Because, and by the way, this is why so many of us in District 3 have been frustrated with David Dennis. Is because for years he's been saying that, oh, I don't know what to do. We'll hold the line. But holding the line means nothing. And he goes back to we didn't raise the mill. Well, raising the mill means nothing when you capture the revenue.
Right.
So I'm glad to hear you say that you will lower mill levies to not capture revenue. That's the key. In 2023, the Kansas Senate passed SCR 1611, which would have limited the annual increase in property valuations to 4%. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I think that is a attempt at a fix, but I don't see the long-term fix in that. I think that if we're capping it, there's going to be more disruption further down the line. What we need to do is become less dependent on our property taxes so that we can not depend on them to carry the government expenses, because government expenses are only going to rise. We as property taxpayers don't need to see that on our tax bills. We as a government need to figure out how to be less dependent on it.
We're talking with Stephanie Wise, candidate for Sedgwick County Commission District 3. On your website, you say, I will always fight against government overreach, which kudos to you. That's been one of my staples whenever I ran for office. It's one of the principles of the show. Can you give us some examples of areas that you see as government overreach and things that you would cut, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we can talk through property rights with that. I think that, you know, we can look to the government to make a lot of decisions for us. And one of those that the government will maybe get a little bit too involved in is property rights. We see that a lot in District 3 with some of the larger landowners that, quite frankly, are having to ask for permission way too many times to do what they need to do for their crops, for their watering, for digging wells. And we don't think about how many steps those farmers have to take to get their job done and how much they do for us.
It's your property. You should be able to do what you want on
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of talk in the Wichita Eagle and other places recently about the county doubling the budgets for the zoo and exploration place, for example, while the jail and EMS have been underfunded. 911, for example, is only at about 60% staffing, for example. Do you think the county is prioritizing their spending the right way?
I think that those are just two different entities to be comparing. So we've got the zoo and the exploration place that are revenue generating to a certain extent. You know, they have their memberships and expenses that are retail that they sell. Our focus needs to be on public safety, period.
So I have to ask you those last question. As you know, my wife and I live in District 3. We've been very concerned about David Dennis. Many of the folks I've talked to in the district are concerned with Dennis because of the lockdowns, votes to raise taxes, et cetera. He has, I believe he's endorsed you. He's attended your fundraisers. He's active at the same time campaigning for Sarah Lopez, the Democrat candidate in District 2. He's doing the same things for her that he's done for you in the past. What do you say to Republicans who are nervous and about, you know, that basically that a vote for you is a third David Dennis term?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you know, I respect David Dennis and his service to our nation as a colonel.
Oh, and me
he
too.
Deserves that.
Set that aside. Yeah. Yes, me too.
I am a different candidate. I do serve on his Citizens Advisory Board. That's how I'm close to the topics at hand. But I am a different candidate. I'm a different generation. I am extremely conservative. And I know as a new candidate, I haven't proven that yet, but I'm not David Dennis, and I'm not going to be.
Well, and I know from our previous conversations, I know that you support the party platform issues. I know where you stand on life. I know where you stand on the Second Amendment.
Yes.
And those matter. Even though people say they're local, this is a local race, those matter. If folks are interested, they can find more information about you. They want to donate or volunteer. They can visit WISE, that's WSIE, for SedgwickCounty.com, and that's FOR, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Thank you.
Stephanie, I appreciate you. I just wish you all the best of luck. I know you're here in a t-shirt and shorts because you were out door knocking today.
Yes, sir.
So I wish you all the best of luck. You've done a great job. Just keep up the good work, all right?
Thank you so much, John.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to go from Wall Street high flyer to the heart of the Trump White House and out again in just 11 days? Anthony Scaramucci, the brash businessman with a knack for headlines, pulls no punches in his new book, From Wall Street to the White House and Back, The Scaramucci Guide to Unbreakable Resilience. Scaramucci is a financier, author, and former public figure. He started his career on Wall Street at Goldman Sachs before founding his own successful investment firm, SkyBridge Capital. Scaramucci has also written several books on finance and business. On the political front, he became, well, briefly served in the White House as communications director under President Trump in 2017. However, his tenure was, well, shall we say, short-lived and has since distanced himself from some of Trump's views. Anthony, thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, I appreciate you reading that introduction the way my mom wrote it. So thank you very much for that. I want to thank you for following her orders.
Well, you know,
pleasure to be on with you.
I was taught how to follow order instructions well, shall we say?
Yeah, there you go. Right, that's also a secret to staying married, by the way.
Amen. But, happy wife, happy life. Right.
Amen. Amen. Well said,
Anthony. I gotta ask. Well, let's talk a little bit about your days in the Trump White House. You were White House Communications Director under President Trump for 11 days. Your relationship with the former president has, let's be gentle, let's say, soured quite a bit since then, to say the least. Looking back, what's it like to be, you know, Donald Trump's communications director, to be within that inner circle?
Well, listen, you know, it's not a personal thing for me. I mean, I can't speak on behalf of the former president, but I enjoyed his personality when I worked for him on the campaign. We got into it a little bit in the White House. We didn't see things 100% the same way. And, you know, so he fired me. And again, he had the right to do that. As I write in the book, I'm fully accountable for my own firing. I don't blame him or General Kelly or anybody. But, you know, what came about with me and President Trump is just a disagreement, a civil disagreement on direction, America, values. One of the things he said to me when I was in the White House, he called me a deep stater, which I found somewhat ironic because I grew up out here on Long Island. I think my time in Washington was those 11 days and maybe one school field trip. So it's very hard for me to be a deep stater. But his point was he wanted us to work for him. And I saw it as us working for the American people, the institution of the presidency. And, you know, then, by the way, that view was not only shared by me, but it was also shared by the vice president. It was shared by many of the cabinet members. And so it's not just me that it's broken from Mr. Trump. There's about 40 of us, including Vice President Pence. And so, you know, listen, it's not a, you know, listen, I'm a big believer in we can have civil disagreement and we can have disagreements on policies. I think where I draw the line is I want to preserve the institutions of the country, the checks and balances of the system. And to quote somebody like Secretary Esper, let's not threaten that. Let's not threaten the checks and balances in the system. Mr. Trump represents that right now. So I'm willing to hold out for what I think will be a different sort of Republican after his candidacy is over.
One
way or another. You know, he's either going to win and spend 4 years in the White House or try to be disruptive to us, or he's going to lose, and hopefully we'll find somebody different than him.
You wouldn't have taken the job had you not seen something in the president. You obviously wanted to work with him. What changed to sour you so much so that now you're one of his most outspoken critics, so much now so that you've called him a traitor? I mean, you've gone so far to the extreme.
Well, he's un-American, so he's the most un-American of the presidential candidates, period. And don't go by me, go by what he's saying. He wants to deport 15 million people. I guess we need to get a Handmaid's Tale armored vehicle. And that won't even just be a show. It'll be a whole, streaming series of deportation, 15 million people. He says he wants to disregard the current system of checks and balances. He's presenting something called Project 2025, which stands for unitary executive power. He says he wants to go after people and empower the FCC. So if you're on the air saying something that he disagrees with, he wants to pull your FCC license. He told two of his defense attorneys that he plans on using the FBI as a Gestapo. He has a list of people that he plans on persecuting after he returns to office. I mean, I could keep going. I mean, but there's a very, very long list of things. These are classically un-American things to do. And so for me, I disagree with that. There are policies, by the way. I see myself fairly objectively. I think there are policies that the president has that I like and I respect, but they're outweighed by some of this other stuff. I mean, the most appalling thing to me, frankly, is the deportation issue. We know from a logistics point of view that this would almost be impossible to prosecute, yet I think you have to take him seriously when he speaks like this. And I think it's a danger to people who don't take it seriously.
Let's take that issue, though. I mean, you've got, on the one hand, let's say you're right, and let's say that's an extreme. But look at Joe Biden, assuming he's competent enough to serve another term. Let's just be honest and say wide open border that we have, where we have a flood of illegals coming in, isn't that just as dangerous to the country?
Well, I certainly don't like that. I think it's less disruptive to the country than goon squads going around the country and ripping people out of people's houses and deporting them. But I don't like that. I don't agree with it. As you know, the president just signed an executive order that's going to stem the tide of that. He should have done that several years ago, frankly. He should have never repealed some of the Trump executive orders. This is the partisan politics. And again, I don't agree with a lot of the things that President Biden stands for. And I've been open about that and honest about it. But it's reminiscent of what Mayor Ed Koch once said. He said, if you agree with 7 out of the 12 things I'm doing, you should vote for me. If you agree with 12 out of the 12 things I'm doing, you need a psychiatrist. And so I don't think you're going to find a politician that your fingerprint politically is going to match their fingerprint. I would like more center right policy move in the country. I'm not for the hard left. I don't agree with that, but I am a pro-business person. Provide historical context for listeners. From George Washington, George W. Bush, $7 trillion of deficit spending. From Barack Obama, Donald Trump, Biden, those three presidents, $28 trillion of deficit spending. And so this is a bipartisan indictment. We've been irresponsible with the Treasury. We've been irresponsible with the overpromising. We either need to tax people more or we need to spend less, but borrowing and printing the money is generational theft. So again, that's a bipartisan indictment.
We're talking with Anthony Scaramucci, author of the new book, From Wall Street to the White House and Back. Let me ask you briefly about the recent trial. You know, now the president's been convicted on 34 counts. Do you think the trial was rigged against the former president? What are your thoughts? I mean, I think you told recently you had an appearance on The Hill on News Nation. You said that the way the jury was instructed by Judge Juan Merchan, it was going to be very tough for them not to come back with some guilty pleas. I think there's many of us who feel like this trial was certainly an uphill climb, to say the least.
So I don't agree with them bringing that case. I've been very public about that. But where we are now is the case was brought. Those were 12 jurists. They're private citizens. They're not necessarily politically motivated. Some of them even admitted that they were Trump supporters. When you have 12 jurists that convict somebody of the crime, I think it's a very difficult thing for the politicians to then go out and suggest that it was rigged and to go out and suggest that the system itself is unfair. He was tried on facts that people agreed to, and he was convicted on those facts. Now, whether or not you should have brought that case against him, and was that a case that I would have brought against him, I would not have brought that case against him. But I don't think we go from not bringing the case against them to the system is unfair and the system is rigged. You know, we can't have that in our society because, number one, it's not true. The president's son is on trial right now for things that he did, and they're selecting a jury. And that's the president's own, quote-unquote, Department of Justice. You've got Bob Menendez on trial for corruption. He's a Democrat. And so we have to have a semblance of fairness and a semblance of predictability in the system. And I think it's wrong for the Republicans to be reading these talking points as if they're loyalty tests to the president. But, yes, I don't – the case wasn't brought. And I want these ideas about America's future litigated on November 5th. I don't think we should be doing this in the judicial system, and I've been very clear about that. But once the case went in there, I don't want our politicians going after our private citizens who are compulsorily required to be jurists in our judicial system.
Do you I know the concept of the book talks about Wall Street and the White House. You've seen firsthand the difference between Wall Street and the White House. So often we say as conservatives, we say that we want to see government be run more like a business. Is that really even possible? Yeah. I mean, the two concepts are so different. Is it even possible to run government like a business?
It's such a good point, sir. You know, I've learned my comeuppance in life. I've been obviously I was fired and I was put through the windmill in the American media. And so I've been humbled by life. I've been humbled by markets. As a lifelong conservative, I can tell you that it's impossible to run the government like a business. Should there be more accountability? Should there be audits of different departments? We know there's several $1 trillion missing at the Defense Department, as an example. Should there be some reckoning or accountability? Certainly. But we also have to understand that the government is trying to provide certain social services and a certain safety net for some of our fellow citizens. And it's also trying to figure out a way to protect and secure Americans through our Defense Department. But remember, the Defense Department is also helping our commerce. You know, we have free shipping lanes all over the world because of the United States Navy and our allies. We have a fair judicial system, which, of course, we have to pay for with our tax dollars. And it's not a business. It's a totally different system. And I would just remind people that during the global financial crisis, whether you're a conservative or you're a liberal, all governments go to the left. You know, George Bush himself, he put forward the $1 trillion spending rescue package during the global financial crisis. Donald Trump, in fairness to him, and I think he does deserve credit for this, there was a number of policies that went into place during COVID to protect the American citizens, and some of that has led to inflation now, but that's nobody's fault. That's just people trying to make good decisions with right. the available information, and obviously there's going to be cost-benefit analysis to every decision.
We've got the new book. It's called From Wall Street to the White House and Back, The Scaramucci Guide to Unbreakable Resilience. It's available on Amazon. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I just try to write an honest story about things that happened to me. If you're having a bad day in your life, as long as it's a health reason, imagine me getting blown from the White House, publicly humiliated on late night comedy, ridiculed by the press and cable news pundits. And how do you come back from that? What do you have to do? How do you got to get your mindset? And I think the big lesson, the resonating message in the book is be kind to other people, live your life with integrity, and don't take yourself that seriously. You know, I don't have a millstone of regret over my mistakes that I hang on my neck in the morning. I don't kick myself in the pants and say, geez, I made a bad decision or said something wrong. I got fired from the White House 7 years ago. I drop all that and move forward in life. And I think that that's the resonating message of the book.
Well, Anthony, again, if folks want to, they can get the book on Amazon. And if they want to connect with you, they can find you on X at Scaramucci, correct?
That's correct, sir. And at Scaramucci on Instagram. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you for joining us. I think you're wrong on the election. I'm not a Biden supporter, but I wish you the very best with the book, sir.
That's what makes America great, my friend. We can disagree.
Yep.
Agreeably.
I agree. Thank you for joining us.
Bye-bye, sir.
Well, he had some connection issues there, but it was still a fascinating conversation that the clicking was a little annoying, but it was still a fascinating conversation. And yes, I'm still voting for a convicted felon. In his new op-ed for DC Journal, Hans von Spakovsky calls the Trump verdict a devastating blow to the sanctity of our justice system and its reputation for fairness and nonpartisanship. He went on to say the Trump verdict makes New York City Venezuela on the Hudson. With us now to explain why he feels the verdict was so bogus is Hans von Spakovsky. Excuse me. He is the senior legal fellow and manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative in the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Justice Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Hans is also a former commissioner on the Federal Election Commission, so he knows a thing or two about election law. Hans, thank you for joining us this evening. It's nice to have you back on the show again, my friend.
Well, John, thanks for inviting me back.
So the former president was convicted on 34, let's remind everybody, misdemeanors for basically a paperwork error. It sure does seem like this was a stretch to one heck of a lot of the electorate. A lot of folks looking at this thing thinking, wow, you know, why wasn't this a slap on the wrist? And you hear pay a fine instead of going to the extent that they did.
Well, in fact, if it had been a misdemeanor, the statute of limitations had already run because those paperwork errors, falsification of a business record, it has a 2-year statute of limitations. So
right.
That long ran. What Alvin Bragg did is he came in and said, well, no, actually, these are felonies because the false business hide another crime. Okay, well, what was that other crime? Oh, well, he said, well, it's this other New York law that says that you've committed a crime if you use unlawful means to promote a candidate in an election. Now, keep in mind that other New York statute that supposedly turned this into a felony was nowhere mentioned in the indictment against Donald Trump.
Right.
Okay. And so, all right, that was step number two. Well, what was the unlawful means that Donald Trump supposedly used? Well, Alvin Bragg claimed that the settlement payment to Stormy Daniels, $130,000, which they tried to paint it as if it was something nefarious, something illegal. It wasn't. It was perfectly legitimate, perfectly legal. What he says is that should have been not listed as a legal expense, which is what it was listed as, but it should have been listed as a campaign-related expense. Okay, well, you know, we've gone step one, step two, step three. Oh, by the way, that claim that it should have been listed as a campaign-related expense, that was also not in the indictment.
Right.
And the problem with claiming that it was a campaign-related expense is actually very simple. Donald Trump was in a federal election. That means federal law applies, not state law. And by the way, the exclusive authority for enforcing that federal law is with the U.S. Department of Justice and the Federal Election Commission, where I once served as a commissioner. No local prosecutor has the right to do that. And in any event, under federal law, that payment to Stormy Daniels would not be considered a campaign-related expense. And people don't have to take my word for it, even though I was a commissioner there, because all they have to do is look at the fact that neither the Federal Election Commission nor the Justice Department considered it a campaign-related expense,
right,
because they didn't prosecute him for it.
Well, and I mean, I've been an elected official. I've been a candidate. If a candidate wants to use his own money to spend on a campaign, he can spend it on whatever he wants because it's his campaign. You can spend personal money, unlimited amounts of personal money on your own campaign for whatever you want. If I'm a rich billionaire and I want to spend $100 million on a blimp for my campaign, I can do it. I could pay off as many hookers, prostitutes, and porn stars as I wanted to of my own money. There's no limit to that. It's not a violation if that's what I wanted to do. So
no, that's exactly right. And here's the other thing. If Donald Trump had actually used campaign money to pay this expense, he would have been prosecuted.
Thank you. That's the crime. Exactly. That would have been a crime if he'd used donations, for example. If he'd actually used money that had been donated to his campaign, that would have been a campaign violation. So, I mean, the whole thing. And then, Hans, this notion that the judge told the jurors that they didn't need to even agree on what the other crimes the defendant had committed. How is that even legal?
It's not. That upsets several hundred years of the law that we've developed in this country, which is very straightforward. A jury has to unanimously agree on every aspect of a crime. And what the judge did was just another sign of how biased he was, and that he was acting as if he was a member of the prosecution team and not a judge.
We're talking with legal expert and former FEC Commissioner Hans von Spakovsky. Hans, with the fairly obvious appearances of bias, should Judge Mershon have presided over this case in the first place, or should he have recused himself? I mean, when you look at the fact that he donated to campaigns, that his daughter's working for a consulting firm that you know has done business for the Bidens, shouldn't Mershon have even recused himself from the case in the first place?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He violated the most basic judicial ethics rules one can imagine. I mean, his family had a financial interest in the outcome of this trial, and yet he didn't recuse himself. Again, another sign of just how biased he was throughout this case. And look, it's very clear that this jury came to this verdict not by actually examining the evidence, or really the lack of evidence in the case, but because it was a biased jury, too. And the way you can see that very easily is, think about this. A six-week trial. 6 weeks. Lots of witnesses. And yet the jury comes back in less than 2 days?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way they could have even begun to review what happened in the case. Less than 2 days, they come back and say, oh, yeah, he's guilty on every count.
Well,
I'm sorry, but that tells you what was really going on here.
Well, based on the instructions they were given by the judge, how could they not come back with a jury with a guilty verdict? But I also have to ask you about what happened on Friday. The judge made the parties aware of a post to the court's system's Facebook page. In the post, a user said, quote, "My cousin is a juror and says Trump is getting convicted. Thank you, folks, for all your hard work." If this has turned out to be true, and that's a big if, but if this turns out to be true, Hans, what are the implications of this revelation?
That is jury misconduct of the worst kind, because that indicates that the jury had already decided to come in with a guilty verdict before they had even begun to review the evidence in the case. That is grounds for instant throwing out of the verdict by the judge. And if, as you say, this turns out to be true and the judge fails to do that, that would be one of the most, not just an error by the judge, but intentional, I think, wrongdoing by the judge.
So how, I mean, this is a big deal. I mean, and I think to his credit, at least Mershon shared it with both attorneys, the state and Trump's attorneys. How do they prove it? What do they do at this point? What happens with this revelation, with this? I mean, what's the steps here that happens now?
Well, the judge, I think, has already scheduled a hearing. He's going to have the lawyers in for both sides, and they're going to have to basically decide how this is going to be investigated. And quite frankly, while it's being investigated, the judge ought to put off and unschedule the hearing that he set up for July, just a couple of days before the Republican National Convention, for
the sentencing,
entry of the verdict and sentencing.
Yeah, because if this turns out to be true, you're right. It means that the jury was predisposed. And yeah. and that means and publicly talking about it. And which that means that this whole thing, well, it means what Trump has said all along was that it was a sham. And I think that's why so many people like myself are saying, hey, you know, I'm voting for a convicted felon, because if it's the trial's a joke, then the conviction's a joke. So, I mean, I don't know, I which is why Trump's raised over $100 million since the conviction.
Right. Right.
But it is sad. And, you know, the point that you make in your op-ed is that, that this isn't, yes, it's bad for Trump. It's bad for the brand, but it's really the sad part is, it's bad for, as you say, the sanctity of our justice system and the reputation of our justice system, because theoretically, Lady Justice is supposed to be blind.
Yeah, that's true. And look, with only rare exceptions, we've had a good justice system because we've never had a system in which the people in power in government used the judicial system to go after their political opponents. That has just is not something that happens in this country. It happens everywhere else in the world, and now it looks like it's happening here. Look, if people think this is exaggeration, think about just one other thing. Donald Trump is being prosecuted by the feds for the mishandling of classified documents when he, as the president, left office. Keep in mind, the president. It has the ultimate authority over whether documents are classified or not.
Right, right.
And at the very same time, this same Justice Department has said, oh, we're not going to prosecute Joe Biden for his mishandling of classified documents, which went on for decades while he was a senator. And when he was vice president, basically stealing documents, classified documents, and taking them home. How can anyone look at those two situations and say that we have not developed a two-tier justice system and that this administration isn't going after its political opponent?
Because, Hans, Joe Biden is a, quote, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory, remember?
Right, right.
Hans, if folks want to connect with you, if they want to read this op-ed, if they want to read other things that you've written, they can find it at heritage.org, correct?
That is correct.
Brother, I appreciate you. It's always good to have you on the show. You're always concise. You bring good information to the show, and I appreciate it, my friend.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for joining us. I've got to share a few things that have been kind of on my mind lately. You know, we talk about these elections. I mentioned it quite a bit, and I've been getting comments quite a bit on what Dan and I talked about in the first hour on whether or not you think taxpayers should be funding the multi, in this case, billion-dollar sports stadiums. It should be pointed out that this is not general fund money. This is not income tax money. It is sales tax money. So it's a little bit different. But I do think people should look into it. I think you should visit, you know, do your own research on this. Americans for Prosperity has some great information on this. I would recommend that you visit AmericansForProsperity.com. You can find out, or .org rather. You get some great information from them on this issue. On the flip side, you know, the organization that we're going to have on next week is Scoop and Score. And that's the group that has been hired to advocate on behalf of this event, or this proposal, shall we say. And, you know, there's pros and cons. I'm trying to stay as neutral on this as I can, which is not easy because I've got friends on both sides of this. And trust me, they're both fighting. This is like when mom and dad fight. This is a tough one because literally it's mommy and daddy are fighting. And I am trying my best not to get involved in this one. So, I really don't want to get involved in this. And they all keep asking and they all keep pushing. And I really don't want to get involved with this particular fight. So I'm going to try and stay neutral as best I can. please don't ask me to get involved. But they've been trying. So I would just recommend you do your own research on this. Like I said, the Kansas Chambers picked a side. Americans for Prosperity has clearly picked a side. But there are conservatives on both sides of this issue. Just make sure you're informed, because I think there's a lot of misinformation on both sides, because there's a lot of passion on both sides. So stay informed, do your research, and call your representatives. They want to hear from you. If you want to know how, if you want them to know how they should vote, how you think they should vote, call them. They need to hear from you. And we'll be here next week. We'll bring you a good, informative show. In the meantime, have a great week and carry on, fellow deplorables.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser-told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
In his new op-ed for DC Journal, Hans von Spakovsky calls the Trump verdict a devastating blow to the sanctity of our justice system and its reputation for fairness and nonpartisanship. He went on to say the Trump verdict makes New York City Venezuela on the Hudson. With us now to explain why he feels the verdict was so bogus is Hans von Spakovsky. Excuse me. He is the senior legal fellow and manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative in the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Justice Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Hans is also a former commissioner on the Federal Election Commission, so he knows a thing or two about election law. Hans, thank you for joining us this evening. It's nice to have you back on the show again, my friend.
Well, John, thanks for inviting me back.
So the former president was convicted on 34, let's remind everybody, misdemeanors for basically a paperwork error. It sure does seem like this was a stretch to one heck of a lot of the electorate. A lot of folks looking at this thing thinking, wow, you know, why wasn't this a slap on the wrist and you here pay a fine instead of going to the extent that they did?
Well, in fact, if it had been a misdemeanor, the statute of limitations had already run because those paperwork errors, falsification of a business record, it has a 2-year statute of limitations. So
right.
That long ran. What Alvin Bragg did is he came in and said, well, no, actually, these are felonies because the false business hide another crime. Okay, well, what was that other crime? Oh, well, he said, well, it's this other New York law that says that you've committed a crime if you use unlawful means to promote a candidate in an election. Now, keep in mind, that other New York statute that supposedly turned this into a felony was nowhere mentioned in the indictment against Donald Trump.
Right.
Okay? And so, all right, that was step number two. Well, what was the unlawful means that Donald Trump supposedly used? Well, Alvin Bragg claimed that the settlement payment to Stormy Daniels, $130,000, which they tried to paint it as if it was something nefarious, something illegal. It wasn't. It was perfectly legitimate, perfectly legal. What he says is that should have been not listed as a legal expense, which is what it was listed as, but it should have been listed as a campaign-related expense. Okay, well, you know, we've gone step one, step two, step three. Oh, by the way, that claim that it should have been listed as a campaign-related expense, that was also not in the indictment.
Right.
And the problem with claiming that it was a campaign-related expense is actually very simple. Donald Trump was in a federal election. That means federal law applies, not state law. And by the way, the exclusive authority for enforcing that federal law is with the U.S. Department of Justice and the Federal Election Commission, where I once served as a commissioner. No local prosecutor has the right to do that. And in any event, under federal law, that payment of Stormy Daniels would not be considered a campaign related expense. And people don't have to take my word for it, even though I was a commissioner there, because all they have to do is look at the fact that neither the Federal Election Commission nor the Justice Department considered it a campaign related expense, because they didn't prosecute him for it.
Well, and I mean, I've been an elected official. I've been a candidate. If a candidate wants to use his own money to spend on a campaign, he can spend it on whatever he wants, because it's his campaign. You can spend personal money, unlimited amounts of personal money on your own campaign for whatever you want. If I'm a rich billionaire and I want to spend $100 million on a blimp for my campaign, I can do it. I could pay off as many hookers, prostitutes, and porn stars as I wanted to of my own money. There's no limit to that. It's not a violation if that's what I wanted to do. So,
no, that's exactly right. And here's the other thing. If Donald Trump had actually used campaign money to pay this expense, he would have been prosecuted.
Thank you. That's the crime. Exactly. That would have been a crime if he'd used donations, for example. If he'd actually used money that had been donated to his campaign, that would have been a campaign violation. So, I mean, the whole thing. And then, Hans, this notion that the judge told the jurors that they didn't need to even agree on what the other crimes the defendant had committed. How is that even legal?
It's not. That upsets several hundred years of the law that we've developed in this country, which is very straightforward. A jury has to unanimously agree on every aspect of a crime. And what the judge did was just another sign of how biased he was, and that he was acting as if he was a member of the prosecution team and not a judge.
We're talking with legal expert and former FEC commissioner Hans von Spakovsky. Hans, with the fairly obvious appearances of bias, should Judge Mershon have presided over this case in the first place, or should he have recused himself? I mean, when you look at the fact that he donated to campaigns, that his daughter's working for a consulting firm that you know has done business for the Bidens, shouldn't Mershon have even recused himself from the case in the first place?
Oh yeah, absolutely. He violated the most basic judicial ethics rules one can imagine. I mean, his family had a financial interest in the outcome of this trial, and yet he didn't recuse himself. Again, another sign of just how biased he was throughout this case. And look, it's very clear that this jury came to this verdict not by actually examining the evidence, or really the lack of evidence in the case, but because it was a biased jury, too. And the way you can see that very easily is, think about this, a six-week trial, 6 weeks, lots of witnesses, and yet the jury comes back in less than 2 days?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way they could have even begun to review what happened in the case. Less than 2 days, they come back and say, oh, yeah, he's guilty on every count.
Well,
I'm sorry, but that tells you what was really going on here.
Well, based on the instructions they were given by the judge, how could they not come back with a jury with a guilty verdict? But I also have to ask you about what happened on Friday. The judge made the parties aware of a post to the court's system's Facebook page. In the post, a user said, quote, "My cousin is a juror and says Trump is getting convicted. Thank you, folks, for all your hard work." If this has turned out to be true, and that's a big if, but if this turns out to be true, Hans, what are the implications of this revelation?
That is jury misconduct of the worst kind, because that indicates that the jury had already decided to come in with a guilty verdict before they had even begun to review the evidence in the case. That is grounds for instant throwing out of the verdict by the judge. And if, as you say, this turns out to be true and the judge fails to do that, that would be one of the most, not just an error by the judge, but intentional, I think, wrongdoing by the judge.
So how, I mean, this is a big deal. I mean, and I think to his credit, at least Mershon shared it with both attorneys, the state and Trump's attorneys. How do they prove it? What do they do at this point? What happens with this revelation, with this? I mean, what's the steps here that happens now?
Well, the judge, I think, has already scheduled a hearing. He's going to have the lawyers in for both sides, and they're going to have to basically decide how this is going to be investigated. And quite frankly, while it's being investigated, the judge ought to put off and unschedule the hearing that he set up for July, just a couple of days before the Republican National Convention, for
the sentencing,
entry of the verdict and sentencing.
Yeah. Yeah, because this, if this turns out to be true, you're right. It means that the jury was predisposed. And yes. And that means, and publicly talking about it. And which that means that this whole thing, well, it means what Trump has said all along, was that it was a sham. And I think that's why so many people like myself are saying, hey, you know, I'm voting for a convicted felon, because if it's the trial's a joke, then the conviction's a joke. So, I mean, I don't know, I which is why Trump's raised over $100 million since the conviction.
Right. Right.
But it is sad. And, you know, the point that you make in your op-ed is that this isn't, yes, it's bad for Trump, it's bad for the brand, but it's really, the sad part is, it's bad for, as you say, the sanctity of our justice system and the reputation of our justice system, because theoretically, Lady Justice is supposed to be blind.
Yeah, that's true. And look, with only rare exceptions, we've had a good justice system, because we've never had a system in which the people in power in government used the judicial system to go after their political opponents. That just is not something that happens in this country. It happens everywhere else in the world. And now it looks like it's happening here. Look, if people think this is exaggeration, think about just one other thing. Donald Trump is being prosecuted by the feds for the mishandling of classified documents when he, as the president, left office. Keep in mind, the president has the ultimate authority over whether documents are classified or not.
Right, right.
And at the very same time, this same Justice Department has said, we're not going to prosecute Joe Biden for his mishandling of classified documents, which went on for decades while he was a senator and when he was vice president, basically stealing documents, classified documents, and taking them home. How can anyone look at those two situations and say that we have not developed a two-tier justice system and that this administration isn't going after its political opponent?
Because, Hans, Joe Biden is a, quote, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory, remember?
Right, right.
Hans, if folks want to connect with you, if they want to read this op-ed, if they want to read other things that you've written, they can find it at heritage.org, correct?
That is correct.
Brother, I appreciate you. It's always good to have you on the show. You're always concise. You bring good information to the show, and I appreciate it, my friend.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for joining us. I've got to share a few things that have been kind of on my mind lately. You know, we talk about these elections. I mentioned it quite a bit, and I've been getting comments quite a bit on what Dan and I talked about in the first hour, on whether or not you think taxpayers should be funding the multi, in this case, billion-dollar sports stadiums. It should be pointed out that this is not general fund money. This is not income tax money. It is sales tax money. So it's a little bit different. But I do think people should look into it. I think you should visit, you know, do your own research on this. Americans for Prosperity has some great information on this. I would recommend that you visit AmericansForProsperity.com. You can find out, or .org, rather. Get some great information from them on this issue. On the flip side, you know, the organization that we're going to have on next week is Scoop and Score. And that's the group that has been hired to advocate on behalf of this event, or this proposal, shall we say. And, you know, there's pros and cons. I'm trying to stay as neutral on this as I can, which is not easy because I've got friends on both sides of this. And trust me, they're both fighting. This is like when mom and dad fight. This is a tough one because literally it's mommy and daddy are fighting, and I am trying my best not to get involved in this one. So, I really don't want to get involved in this. And they all keep asking and they all keep pushing, and I really don't want to get involved with this particular fight. So I'm going to try and stay neutral as best I can. Please don't ask me to get involved. But they've been trying. So I would just recommend you do your own research on this. Like I said, the Kansas Chambers picked a side. Americans for Prosperity's clearly picked a side. But there are conservatives on both sides of this issue. Just make sure you're informed. Because I think there's a lot of misinformation on both sides. Because there's a lot of passion on both sides. So stay informed. Do your research. And call your representatives. They want to hear from you. If you want them to know how they should vote, how you think they should vote, call them. They need to hear from you. And we'll be here next week. We'll bring you a good, informative show. In the meantime, have a great week and carry on, fellow deplorables.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser-told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.